RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Hello and welcome to RDI Insights. My guest today is the civil aerospace design engineer, Jeff Kirk. He's had a long and successful career that started with a childhood passion for aircraft and many hours spent constructing balsa wood models. He was an only child with parents who took a keen interest in his education and helped him along the way. And that path eventually led him to Rolls-Royce, where he worked for 30 years, eventually graduating to his dream position as Chief Civil Aerospace Design Engineer, overseeing hundreds of designers. During his long career at Rolls-Royce, major achievements, including his conceptual design for the Trent 500, the sole power plant used in the Airbus 340, 500 and 600 aircraft, and the Trent 900 for the Airbus A380, as well as leading the team responsible for designing the original version of the Trent 1000. On his retirement in 1998 from Rolls-Royce, rather than put his feet up, he entered a career in design education as visiting professor at Queen Mary, University of London, and the University of Nottingham, that he continues to this day. In 2002, he was awarded the Prince Philip Designers Prize, and in 2006, for his services to education, he was given the Sir Misha Black Award. I talked to him about his life and work, and his view on the future of commercial aviation and the harm that its polluting emissions have caused to our planet. We recorded our conversation remotely with Jeff in Leicestershire and me at my home in Dorset. I started with the question that many people wonder about when looking out of the aircraft window as it starts to roll along the runway. How does a fully laden A380 Airbus weighing around 589 tons, lift off the ground, stay up, and safely land back on terra firma?
Well, the gas turbine principle is very, very similar to a car engine. I mean, people always talk about suck, squeeze, bang, blow for a car engine.
Yeah,
you've heard that. Well, basically, the gas turbine is very similar in terms of there is the suck, which is the get the air going in through the intake. There is the squeeze, where the thing is compressed, partially by the fan. And then by a series of compressors. And then instead of a squeeze, it's a burn. The whole thing goes into a combustion chamber. And it's very much like a plumber's blow lamp. You've got the flame there, and basically you've got this very high pressure air, and then you raise its temperature. And you raise the temperature up to something like 1600 or 1700 degrees centigrade. And then this hot air, you then push that through a turbine, and the purpose of the turbine is simply to drive the compressor in the first place. So you're taking work out at this point back to drive the compressor, but then you've got a lot of energy left over, and you can use this, you can squirt this air through a nozzle, and this gives you the thrust at the back. So it's a continuous process, and when the air leaves the combustion chamber, it goes into the turbine, and the turbine is operating in air which is above the turbine blade's melting temperature. So the turbine blade has to be cooled using 600 degree temperature air to cool it, but it's obviously a lot cooler than the environment that it's in. So you're talking of very robust materials for the turbines. And sometimes what you can do, instead of taking all the air through the core of the engine, you can put some air around the outside, sometimes known as a bypass engine, and so that you get a lot of thrust from the fan at the front. And it's very much like a propeller, except it's got a propeller. It's limited on how fast you can run a propeller, because the tip speed of the propeller, if you try and fly it at 8/10 of speed of sound, the tip of the propeller is supersonic. And it breaks away. So that's what the purpose of the intake is. So you can slow the air down and fly at 0.85 Mach number. And basically, on the aeroplane, when you take off, obviously you need a lot of thrust because you're probably at sea level or close to sea level. So that's when you get your maximum thrust, because the air is very dense. that point. So that's where you're getting a lot of thrust to get the airplane rolling down the runway so that it gets to its takeoff speed. And then you can take off. Then the climb, the engine is pulled back very slightly from its takeoff thrust. And you go into a climb. And what you want to do is get to your cruising altitude very quickly, because when you get to your cruising altitude, you can you can pull back the power, and because the air is less dense, and so the drag is less dense, so you need less thrust, so you can use less fuel. And this really goes back to Frank Whittle's real aim. He wasn't really interested in designing a gas turbine. The gas turbine was a means to an end. What he wanted to do, he wanted to fly long range. And the only way he could fly long range was to fly high. And a propeller won't let you to fly high. So that's why he went to the gas turbine.
Okay, so we're up in the air, and coming down is fairly straightforward, I guess.
That's right, yes. All you do really is you throttle the engines back. And let gravity do the job. And you hardly need any power on approach. This approach power is quite low on the engine, because you're moving fairly slowly. You're down to 140 knots, 150 knots to land.
Well, now we've successfully landed, let's go back in time to your early life. You were born in 1945, a year before World War II ended, and raised in Arnold, which is a suburb of Nottingham. And you were the only child of Eric and Lily Kirk.
That's correct.
So what did your parents do?
Well, my father, during the war, was a fitter at the local ordnance depot. He was a reserved occupation. And then after the war, he took over the coal and haulage business that my grandfather had started when he came back from the First World War. And my mother helped in the business.
What are your earliest memories of home life? And what was your home like at that time in Arnold? But what was the first sort of thoughts that you really can remember as a child there?
We lived on a small lane that was fairly well out into the country. And I can remember playing quite a lot with my contemporaries on the lane. There was a crowd of us, I suppose, all baby boomers. We went over the fields and we had all sorts of adventures and things like that.
Those days of being with a group of friends, you were just allowed to do anything and everything.
And we played football and cricket on the road. There was no traffic.
None at all.
That's right. And we would get rides with the local farmer on his tractor and things like that. And play hide and seek in Crudgington's Wood.
And I suppose, certainly where I live, you know, things were still delivered by the bakery with a horse and a cart. It seems so ancient. Was it the same for you?
Yes. And the milkman had an electric float, and we used to catch a ride with him and deliver milk for him, and he gave us rides on his electric float.
How would you describe yourself as a very young boy? What kind of things grabbed you? And I mean, you were an only child, so did that mean you spent a lot of time at home by yourself, or did you have just lots of friends?
I had lots of friends, but the thing that I was always interested in was aircraft. One of my first recollections was my cousin taught me to draw an aeroplane in three dimensions. He was about 4 or 5 years older than me. And I used to sketch this aeroplane repeatedly until I perfected it. And it was only years later that I realised it was the Percival Mew Gull that I was sketching.
Right.
This is when I was 5 or 6.
So that's infant school time.
Yes. And then when I went to junior school, we had a very good teacher who talked to us about internal combustion engines. I knew what a two-stroke engine and a four-stroke engine was. And he introduced me to making balsa wood models, flying models. That was all at junior school. So we started doing all that.
So the whole notion of what you would ultimately become was kind of percolating way back then, your passion for aircraft.
That's right. And then when I was about 13 or 14, I joined the local air training corps because my intention at that time was I had an interest. I thought, well, I might end up in the RAF, you see. And I had a great time there because we went flying and I got my gliding license just after my 16th birthday, before my motorbike license. And it stood me in good stead because years later I did a private pilot's license and so that all stood me in good stead. But it was a great time that was in the Air Training Corps.
How long did that last for, the Air Training? Was that a...
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah, and then when I took a job, I moved away from the area slightly, so I had to resign from the Air Training Corps at that time. So when I was about 17, resigned from that. And then, of course, I was a very keen rugby player and cyclist. So I had a great community of rugby players and cyclists. So I was off playing rugby or training during the week, and I played for the school in the morning and the club in the afternoon.
So sports were very important to you, clearly.
Yes, very much so.
You said you did the pilot training. What were you flying at that time? What were they training you in?
The Air Experience flights were in... They were the two-seater trainers, chipmunks.
Chipmunks. Oh, yes. Right, okay. Okay. Did you fly solo in that?
No, not till later. Not till I was about 30. My wife said, you should go and learn to fly. I said, well, we can't afford it. She said, well, we'll never will be able to, so you better go and do it now. So I flew from about 30 till about 55, I flew.
Oh, well, perhaps we can talk a little bit about that later. That's jumping forward. So let's, with the young you, and let's just go through your schooling. Obviously, after infant school, you would have gone to your secondary school. And would you say you were pretty academic?
I wouldn't say I was academic at all, really. I, at the local junior school, I passed the 11 plus, as it were, in those days. And I think my teachers recognised that my interests were really technical and encouraged me to go to a technical school rather than a grammar school. The technical schools were set up by the Butler Education Act in... 1944, to improve technical education with emphasis on practical subjects. So that's what I did. I went to the technical school.
Is that the Loughborough Technical College?
No, this is earlier.
The Bramcott one.
And there I really liked the technical side of it, maths, engineering, technical drawing and metalwork. They were sort of my favourite subjects at that time.
So that was really pretty hands-on.
Yes, we had a wonderful workshop at that time.
So then what happened following on from that tech school? You moved on to another level somewhere else?
No, well, when I was 16, I took GCEs, and then I thought, well, I really need to think about what I'm going to do. And the school advice was, careers advice, was not particularly good. And my father had connections with the local employment office for the business. So I went along and talked to the youth employment office, and I met a lady there, and I can't remember her name, but she had a significant effect on my life because she said to me, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be a pilot or an engineer. And she said, well, my advice to you, she says, is be an engineer and earn a living and fly for pleasure. And she said, and by the way, what you should do if you want to be an engineer, the thing you should do is join a company and they will put you through an education, do a drawing office student apprenticeship. And these are the best companies to go to, right to Brush Electric, Rolls-Royce and Jaguar, which is what I did. And very quickly, I got a reply from Brush Electric inviting me for an interview. And I went along to the interview. There were a lot of applicants. There were about 20 places, a lot of applicants for that. And I think I must have made an impression on the interviewer, because at that time, in the metalwork classes, what I used to do, I used to design and make little tools to maintain my pushpipe. And he asked me what I did for hobbies, and I said, oh, I cycle and I make these tools, you see. And he was quite impressed with these things. Anyway, they offered me a job as a drawing office student apprentice. And my father said, well, you must write and accept that. which I did. And then about a week later, Rolls-Royce invited me for an interview. And my father said, well, you can't go. You accepted the Brush Electric job. You can't go and talk to Rolls-Royce. You've given your word to Brush Electric. You must accept that job. I said, yes, but I want to work for Rolls-Royce. You've given your word, you see. So I ended up at Brush Electric.
Now, they manufactured electrical generators and...
They did. They did diesel electric locos, switchgear, transformers,
yeah.
large rotating machines, electrical machines, large rotating electrical machines. And it was actually an excellent apprenticeship. And I spent 6 months, over a year, I spent 6 months at college and 6 months in the factory on the shop floor.
What age were you then?
From 16 to 21.
To 21. And so following that...
I worked for Brush for 2 years after my apprenticeship. And then in 1968, Rolls started recruiting. And I'd been at Brush, I'd been designing special purpose machines and equipment. And I joined Rolls-Royce doing something fairly similar, but just... bigger, hotter and faster at Rolls, designing special purpose rigs and equipment. And that was in 1968. I joined Rolls at that time.
You were 21, weren't you, at that time?
About 24. I finished my apprenticeship at 21, and then I did 2 years at Brush, and then I moved to Rolls.
23.
24, yeah, something like that. Because they just got a big order for the original RB211 in the TriStar. So I joined them and enjoyed the time that I was there. And after about in 1970, they sent four of us back to university, to Loughborough University this time, not the college, to the Engineering Design Centre. And these Engineering Design Centres had been set up by Fielden around the country. There's about four or five Engineering Design Centres. And these were there really to concentrate on teaching engineering design. And it was quite a small organisation run by a guy called Professor Chaddock, wonderful chap it was. And so I went there for supposedly for a full year, 48 weeks. And this was really a significant point in my development as a designer. It opened my eyes working at that, because I realised that I'd sort of been doing design work, but I now understood why I was doing it. It was sort of those things, and I could see that design was a process that transcended all sorts of sectors, automotive, because we were mixing with automotive engineers, electrical engineers, and we were all doing the same thing. Just the only difference was the domain knowledge that we had about it, really. I wondered why all graduates weren't taught this sort of thing.
So this was a relatively new form of teaching. Yes. I mean, how long had it been in existence?
We were probably about the second or third group in. It had been going about 2 or 3 years.
And why was it established? They wanted somehow to focus on the design organisational aspect,
yes,
rather than just the making. The process became the important thing. They could actually use that in other areas. They could just transfer it to other forms of engineering.
Yes, the Fielden report was what it was really talking about was the fact that the engineering education at that time was really applied mechanics. And what the Fielden report was trying to do was trying to move the engineering education more into a practical, rather more practical thing, and encouraging people to become designers with a design. For instance, we discussed things like understanding requirements, understanding the customers, creativity, and that type of thing, which was never taught in undergraduate at that time. And so it opened my eyes to quite a lot of opportunities, if you like, as a designer, as well as an engineer.
Well, let's go on, you know, following on from that, how you progressed in your job as a design engineer, which is a very long one. So I think there must have been a lot of stages along the way where it's odd, because when I first started to think about you, you know, you automatically assume if you're not knowledgeable about your particular world, which I'm certainly not. I mean, apart from looking in the Eagle comics at the exploded drawings of jet planes and things, that's as far as my brain can take it. And you automatically assume, well, you know, Jeff has been involved in, you know, the design of jet engines, but that's it's a massively complicated business with teams of people. So I'm fascinated to know exactly how, you know, over the years you got to the position that you did. So I think that's going to be the really interesting part of this, because it daggers me when I look at these things. Can we go through that path?
Yes, of course. I should sort of just link what we've just been talking about to the point that I'll come on to. Because while I was at the Engineering Design Centre, Rolls-Royce went bankrupt and I couldn't go back to the engine division. And they moved me into Rolls-Royce and Associates, and I worked on nuclear submarines, on the nuclear steam racing plant for the submarines. And that was a time where I didn't really get much satisfaction from designing in there. It wasn't satisfying to me at all. And I left after about 2 years, and I went to a small firm who made radio and TV components, really almost consumer products.
Wow, that's a big change.
It was. And I designed radio and TV components for them, went out with the marketeers, and it was a real eye-opener of what a small business was. It was a soup-to-nuts type of job. And then Rolls started recruiting again in about 1974, and I got a call saying, look, we're recruiting again. Would you like to come back? So back I went. Now, it might be useful at this point, really, to outline the various design roles that go off in an engine.
Absolutely.
First of all, the function of the engine is to provide power. That's its sole function, either to propel the aircraft or to provide hydraulics or electrics or pneumatics services to the aircraft. That's what its job is, just converting fuel into power.
Yeah.
And an engine is made up of several subsystems. So there's the compression, combustion, turbines, the propelling nozzle, and it's got its own internal air systems, fuel systems and oil systems to keep it going. So there are specialist design groups who specialise in compressors, turbines, combustion, but then this is all brought together at the whole engine level. When you're starting to design a new engine, it's initiated by the airframer. We can never design an engine without an aeroplane. And so it's the chief design engineer's role to define the architecture that satisfies the airframer's and the certifying authority's requirement. And in doing that, you have to flow down requirements to the various subsystems, compressors, turbines, and so on, and receive back their bids, if you like, and integrate that into a whole. And then after a number of iterations of going round and round all this thing, you can come to a concept which satisfies the airframer's requirements, and then that can go out to airlines for them to make a bid, and you go out to the airline with a guarantee of fuel consumption cost, lifetime maintenance cost, all that sort of thing. And this iteration can take a long time. For instance, the Trent 900 in the A380, it took 4 years from initiation to getting a formal launch. So this toing and froing goes round, because the airframer has to talk to the airline. The airline comes back, and then and the whole thing. And of course, it's very competitive as well, because probably two engine companies are bidding for this. So we're all the time being ratcheted by the airframer to improve fuel consumption and so on. So that point, then, once the thing's launched, guaranteed the performance of the engine, you guarantee the cost, the weight, everything. And then it's passed to a project chief design engineer who is accountable for the embodiment of putting the whole thing together, integrating and monitoring the subsystems they've promised that they're going to deliver, And there's innumerable design decisions, detailed design decisions, have to be made in order to bring this thing to fruition. And this is the point where the engine then goes through, it's manufactured, and it goes through a certification program where there's probably 9 or 10 engines running on test beds to prove that the thing is, it will deliver the thrust and the fuel consumption and also the reliability of the engine. And then once the thing's certified and goes into service, there is another chief design engineer, project chief design engineer, who oversees the thing in service and manages the slight modifications that has to go into the end for improving reliability, reducing cost, improving fuel consumption while the engine's in service. And that will continue on for probably 7 or 8 years until the engine starts to become mature.
So these are like little upgrades.
Yes.
Like with motor cars, when you get a recall, exactly. When they have to tweak them. Yeah.
Exactly. So when I went back to Rolls, what I did, I went in, my job was designing the internal air systems and oil systems for these engines. So I was in one of the subsystem groups, if you like, working away at that. And after about 2 years, I went back to my previous department, specialising designing rigs. But this time I went back, I was leading a team of about 10 designers in my previous department, you know, the one that I'd been in before I went to Loughborough. And that was my first introduction, if you like, to man management, managing those 10 guys. And then I moved fairly quickly into designing leading a team for the engine fans and compressors with about 25, 30 designers, designing the real engine stuff this time.
Yeah.
The fans and the compressors. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. And then there was an opportunity came for an assistant project chief design engineer on the original RB211, the one that had gone into service in 1972. Mm-hmm. This was about 1979, so the engine had been in service 7 or 8 years. But there's an opportunity to do work on a real engine in service rather than the subsystems. And I applied for that, and I got that. Very quickly, the project chief design engineer left for another appointment, so I stepped into his role fairly quickly. So I became the chief design engineer for this in-service engine. And then there's the design organisation, and then there's another organisation that is responsible for managing the engine development programmes, who order parts, get engines to test, run the engines, strip them, examine them, and all that sort of thing. And I was persuaded, against my wishes, I was persuaded to go into that department as what's called the chief development engineer. And I didn't really want to do that. But I realised later, as you do when you look back, that really it was a planned career move for me, that I needed to broaden my horizons, if you like, away from the design organisation and learn about managing engine programmes. So I did learn a lot doing that particular thing. And then what would have been about 1982 now, I was put into the role of the chief design engineer, project chief design engineer for a new engine, the 535E4 it was called, which was for the 757. And it was the first new engine since the original RB211 that Rolls had done. And Boeing had launched a new aeroplane for the first time with a non-American engine. The architecture had been agreed with Boeing, and American Airlines had placed an order for 70 of these aircraft, 2 engines per aircraft. So we then had to start. We got the architecture done. Another team of people had got the architecture done. Then it was my job to bring that into a production version by bringing all the subsystems together and integrating it all. And, of course, having worked on the service engines, I knew a lot of the pitfalls and problems that we'd encountered. So we'd learned a lot of lessons during the 1970s, and it stood us in good stead. And the E4 on the 757, it became the most reliable engine ever to enter service. And Iceland Air operated one for over 40,000 hours on the wing All they did was put fuel and oil in it, and it didn't come off the wing for 40,000 hours. The 1970s at Rolls-Royce, I always describe it as the company being in an apprehensive crouch. We never knew what problem was going to hit us. And of course, we were owned by the government at that time. It wasn't until 86 that we were privatised again, and the whole atmosphere changed in 86 when we were privatised, because we were masters of our own destiny here once more, and we'd done this new engine which was selling well, and we thought, well, we can do something right. And then I moved on after that. When that went into service, I went on, we come into collaboration with Pratt & Whitney, Japanese Aero Engines and MTU, to provide an engine for the Airbus A320. And I became the chief engineer on the engine called the V2500. I was responsible for the Rolls-Royce bit of it, which was the fan and the compressor. So I was responsible, the chief engineer, for that particular bit. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. And then Rolls have a large research program, some of which is done in-house and some of which is with universities and research organisations. And it's a forward-looking thing. You look, when you're doing research, you look 8 to 10 years hence. What do the engines in 10 years' time need? And therefore, what materials do I need to develop, or what techniques do I need to develop that are going to come to fruition in 8 to 10 years? So I was the chief engineer for research and manufacturing technology for 2 or 3 years. And that was quite good, because I got involved with a lot of universities that universities were doing. It was quite interesting, because I had a reasonable budget, and I was reasonably free on how I managed it. And I used to talk to the prelim design people, more of which later, about what their vision was for 10 years, and then we'd decide what technologies we'd need to put into place. And I used to spend about 80% of my budget on things that I knew we would need, and about 20% on blue skies, or speculative research, things that you didn't really know. One or two things that really came about because of that, you know, this speculative research. You shouldn't always spend everything on everything you've got. You need to speculate a little bit.
You mentioned the university connections. How was that integrated into what you were doing? Were they looking at these future areas?
Yes. What we would do, the company set up university technology centres. So what we would do, we would give a university a 5-year contract, which would enable them to recruit researchers, postdoc researchers or doctoral researchers, and they would then be able to work for 2 years, and this would be reviewed after 3 years. So it was a rolling contract. And so, for instance, Nottingham has a university technology centre in transmission systems and manufacturing. Southampton were on computing. Cambridge did knowledge capture research and reuse. York did electrical stuff. Loughborough did combustion. And so we had about 19 of these around the country. So the university were then able to set up a research organisation that could invest in equipment, they could invest in researchers. With the knowledge that they got this rolling contract, gave them security. And then we'd set them targets. We'd agree the targets, what they'd do. We'd agree the how much money they would have. We'd monitor progress towards the objectives.
So they were your little kind of outposts of looking at these important areas would actually, you know, come to fruition in many years to come. And so they were all funded by Rolls-Royce within universities.
Yes.
Obviously, we can talk about it later because we will go on to your teaching. But is that something they still do? They still
very much
fund?
So.
Yes, okay.
Very much so, yeah. And in fact, I think they've got now about 30, because they've introduced some overseas ones. I mean, there's one in Singapore, there's some in Norway doing various things. So I think they've expanded the project, the concept.
And so clearly it worked.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And you see, the point about the universities is the universities, if you like, in terms of knowledge, they are narrow and deep, whereas in industry we tend to be broad and shallow.
And they've got the time to concentrate on specific areas.
Absolutely.
Whereas Absolutely. You know, you're within a commercial proposition where you're probably got to get the next engine out.
And what I used to say to them, I said, what I want you to do, I want you to come knocking on my door.
Yeah.
And say, look, you should be doing this.
Mm.
you're the experts in these things. You should be telling me what I should be doing.
Out of those associations, you probably picked up some pretty bright people that came probably to work within Rolls-Royce.
Oh, we did. It was a good recruiting ground.
Yes.
And it was also a good training ground because we could put some of our engineers into the UTC for a couple.
So that all came about because you were no longer owned by the government. You became a commercial enterprise and so was able to, we're living in an age at the moment where most people, sort of denigrate the passing of so many things that were state-owned and now privately owned, because we all end up paying vast sums of money to people. But maybe in the case of Rolls-Royce, it's completely different. So, okay, where are you at now in your your story?
Well, I did a short spell in power plant.
Yes, I wanted to know about
that. Once you've got the engine, you've got the bare engine, you need to wrap it in a nacelle, the shiny bit on the outside.
The container. I've thought about this, and it's a bit like product design. Product designers that we know often work in two ways. They're either the person that creates the packaging, if you like, beautifully, or they get involved with the engineering inside, or a bit of both, moving things to create more interesting spaces. So the packaging of the jet itself is a rather beautiful, aerodynamic, wonderful thing, isn't it? And that's designed by someone. That's the, if you like that, that's the enclosure. That's the box that it's in.
That's right. That's the box. And of course, associated with that, you see, is the thrust reverser. So there's the intake. The engine has got the fan and all the compression bits and all the bits and pieces put together. And then what you need to do, you need to have an intake, an aerodynamic intake on it, which has got noise treatment in front of the fan, tubular bit.
Yes.
And that's got noise treatment in for noise suppression. And it's a very complex aerodynamic design because the air has to come in to the intake, because when the airplane's flying along at 8/10 the speed of sound, the air is trying to swallow that, and the fan can't cope with air coming at it at 8/10 the speed of sound, so you have to slow it down.
I see.
So when it comes to the intake, the intake has a swallowing capacity, and then there is a diffusing passage. The passage gets wider. Air slows down. So it slows down to about half the speed of sound. And that's the purpose of the intake. And then, of course, the excess air has got to go over the outside. And what you don't want it to do, you don't want that to cause a lot of drag. So the shape on the outside is there to minimise external drag. And then there is the thrust reverser that's bolted onto the back. And then all that lot has to be mated to the aeroplane, to the structure under the wing, and all the services plumbed in. So I was doing that for a couple of years.
So you're slowly working your way down through all the component parts of the engine. It seems to be gradually going through it. So what was next?
Well, then in 1994, that when I really achieved my long-term ambition, when I became the Chief Design Engineer for Civil Aerospace. And in that, I was responsible for the concept design of all new engines. And I had a very close-knit team of about 50 designers. And we would work on projects in conjunction with the airframers. So we will work with Boeing, Airbus, Embraer, Gulfstream on various engine projects. We would design engines in response to them. About half of them would never see the light of day. We'd work with them and the project would fold, and then sometimes they would come to fruition. And this was where we were working. This was the 4 or 5 years time of the design, working with an airframer until something came to fruition. And then also at that time, I became responsible for the design process throughout the company. We had what we call process owners. So there's somebody responsible for the noise process, the turbine design process, the compressor design process. And I was responsible for the design process in general. And what that meant was that I was responsible for recruitment, training and progression of all the designers throughout the company, not just in civil business. And so I was responsible for about the careers for about 900 designers. They didn't all report to me, but I was responsible for their methods, if you like, that they used. And this was an opportunity to start putting into place some of the things that I'd learned at Loughborough Design Centre. And changing the way that a large company works is a very slow process.
Yes, and often you come up against a lot of brick walls. You know, the idea of change is very difficult for some to swallow.
That's right. That's right. So that was really my ultimate job, if you like. That's the thing I really wanted to do. And I managed to spend, although I was responsible for the design, recruitment and training and things, I did manage to spend 50% of my time on the technical stuff. I did manage to keep my hands on things on the technical side of the business.
That must have pulled you in several ways. So you're obviously very good at organising your time and breaking up the component parts in your head to work on these different things. I mean, clearly you must be very gifted in that, to have got to that important stage in your life. Was there anywhere else to go after that, in terms of that position?
Not really for me. That was the ultimate. That was the ultimate design position in the company, the chief design engineer for the company. And of course, that's what other RDIs have done. Like Arthur Rubra was the chief design engineer for the company. So I was sort of following in his step, and I was in that job until I retired in 2007.
We've got to the point where you've got the very job that you always wanted and loved and cherished. And then you decide that it's time to leave. Did you decide to leave, or was there a natural, you know, understanding that when you get to a certain point, you move on? How did that come about?
Well, my normal retirement age was 62, and a lot of my colleagues had retired early because they could, because of the pension scheme that we were on. But I stayed on because I liked my job, so I stayed on. But what we did about 2 years beforehand, we decided what we were going to do, and we told two who were going to split the job. We sent one guy off to Germany for a couple of years, and then they came back in October 2006, and we put them in place, and then I stayed on till February 2007 when I retired. So we had a transition. So they were in place for about 4 or 5 months, and we had a handover period. So it was quite a well-managed handover thing, organisation. And so I retired really at my normal retirement age.
As with many, would have a good rest and go on a good holiday and potter about in the garden. What did you do?
If we go back to about 1990, the Royal Academy of Engineering set up a visiting professor scheme where they offered universities some money to engage people from industry to get involved in doing lectures, advising on courses and things like that. I was asked by Queen Mary in London if I'd be a Royal Academy visiting professor. So that's exactly what I started to do in about 1995. I joined them. And then, in as you know, I was working with UTCs, and one of the UTCs was at Nottingham, and the head of department came to one of the directors, said, did I know anybody who could take over PP's role at Nottingham? And I said, yes, I probably know one or two people who could do that. And he said, no, you know, that's the wrong answer. I'd like you to come and be a VP at Nottingham. In 2000, I started being a visiting professor at Nottingham as well. So in 2007, when I retired, because travelling up and down to London was for a lecture, it was took out a day for a couple of lectures. What I did, I agreed to work with Nottingham for 2.5 days a week, which I still do as an honorary professor. And what I do there is I lecture first and second year mechanical engineers in design. And this is where the teachings that I had, benefit I had at Loughborough, I bring into the first year design at Nottingham. And because the Engineering Council now, over a period of time, are very keen on design, and design is a spine that runs throughout the whole of the 4 year course. So in each year, there is an individual design project and then a group design and make and test project in each year. And design, as I describe it, is a spine that runs through everything, and all the other modules feed in at the appropriate point for that. And then I lecture on propulsion for third year, and and I manage the group design and make test projects for the third year.
You really don't seem to have very much free time. You do seem to work as hard as you worked when you were within Rolls-Royce, or is that an exaggeration?
Oh, that's very much an exaggeration.
Is it?
Academia is so easy.
Oh, is it? Well, you obviously enjoy it. I mean,
oh, I do. I
think, and from what I understand, you have a gift for enthusing the students, and that's really important. I mean, to engage young people, full stop, can be a challenge.
Terrific. I mean, they ask you all the awkward questions.
Yes.
Yes, but why is it like that? And why? What? Yes, but why have you done it like that? And they love all the war stories. They love all the things that went wrong. You know, they love that sort of.
And it obviously keeps you on your toes. It keeps your brain working. It's a
absolutely
terrific way. I mean, so much so that you were awarded the Sir Misha Black Medal for your services to education, which is well deserved. During the COVID pandemic that we've all been through over the last several years, there was a point when you couldn't hear a plane at all for about a year.
Yes.
And you heard bird songs and so forth. It was just a completely weird and different environment. And obviously, I know you spent a lot of your time trying to minimize as much noise and pollution as possible. That was one of your parts of your job. That's what you were doing. But even now, we know that, you know, the term of benefit to society is kicked around a lot, particularly within the RSA. And obviously, flying is a benefit to society because, you know, it's amazing how you can get from A to B so quickly. Mm-hmm. But obviously, there's another side to it, and that is it still pollutes and it's still noisy. So I wanted to get your view on how you see the future of flying for ordinary people, because I think it's only a small proportion overall that really use aircraft when it comes down. I think I read somewhere that it said that only 10% of the population are frequent flyers, which I thought, wow, that seems to be rather amazing. But apparently that's what Greenpeace say. What's your view of the future of flying?
Well, if you go back to the start of the wide-bodied jets, the jumbo, the 747, back in 1970, that was the first time that airfares came within the reach of the average wage earner. And from that time, air transport, air traffic, has grown at about 4% per annum. And if you work that out, that means that air traffic doubles in 20 years. Every 20 years it will double. And this has gone on for every year, 4%. It's been, and the predictions have always been, well, it's going to be 4%. It will vary from place to place. Now, say 2018, 2019, the view was it's going to be 4%. And where's the growth going to come from? Well, the growth is going to come not necessarily from Europe, which is going to be around about 3.5%, 5% in the States. But the big growth is going to be the 8-10% in India and China. Gross domestic product is growing. People will want to travel. So it's been like that. And the view was that it's going to continue on. And I always worry about this is looking at the precedents, is looking at the past and trying to predict the future from it. And I say to the students, it's a bit like trying to drive a car by looking out the rear window. You know, you're looking at the past to try and predict where you're going to go. But then, of course, there's been blips along the way. There was SARS, there was various financial crises, and 9/11, of course, where things stopped for a while.
Yes.
But it recovered. Each year it recovered. But then in 2019 or 2020, COVID was a major disruption, and it fell back to 2010 levels. The prediction is that it will start to recover in probably 2024, 2025. Aviation, it contributes about 2.5% of carbon into the atmosphere. Of all human-induced carbon dioxide emissions, it's 2.1%. So, and things like the internet are actually contribute more CO2 because of all the electricity.
Yes, I gather with all those huge buildings all over the world, red hot, sending their little signals all over the place. Yes.
Having said that, the aerospace industry has always been proactive. For instance, in 1995, we had what we call the ACARI targets, which was the research organisations for Europe, which determined what the targets were going to be for CO2, for instance. And the target was that that new aircraft would reduce CO2 by 50% from 1995 to 2020. And of course, you've got the existing aircraft, which will continue on for 25 years. So you don't immediately get a 50% improvement. Only the new aircraft have the 50% benefit. And that was fairly well achieved. The other problem with aviation is putting nitrous oxide into the upper atmosphere and contrails in the upper atmosphere, and what the effect on global warming is that. But the major contribution has been around CO2. So IATA has set the objective to be net zero carbon by 2050. So the aviation industry will not put any more carbon into the atmosphere in 2050. Now, there are a number of strategies that are posed to do this, and quite frankly, simply making aircraft and engines more efficient, if the growth continues at that 4%, making them more efficient won't hack it. Just making them more efficient engines, more efficient aircraft won't do it. You've got to change the energy source of the aircraft. And of course, the ones that come out, people say, oh, what about electricity? Well, yeah, fine, batteries could be used, but the trouble with a battery is the energy density is pretty poor. You don't get quite a big, heavy battery for a small amount of power. And of course, the more energy you put into it, the more like a little bomb it becomes. So you always have to be careful with batteries, you know, of catching fire. Especially, you've heard of instances of batteries catching fire. So there is a possibility that you could get electrical, but of course, the electricity's got to be generated, and got to be generated in a clean manner in the first place. And then there's hydrogen.
That seems to be coming back.
The problem with hydrogen, in gaseous form, it takes up a lot of space, so the aircraft has to have large spaces to store the hydrogen. If you can reduce the volume by making it cryogenic, turn it into liquid, but then of course you've got the problem how to keep it cool, not only in the aircraft but also at the airport. So there's a lot of energy then required in order to keep it cool. So you might get some aircraft hydrogen powered, and Rolls have been working on hydrogen powered. See, basically, gas turbine will run on hydrogen anyway. There's very little you need to do. It's just another fuel. A gas turbine will run on domestic heating oil. So that's not a particular problem for the engine. It's the management of the thing and the supply chain that's the problem with hydrogen. But you could see that being used in short haul applications. I think the key is sustainable aviation fuel, and sustainable aviation fuel is produced from waste gases, crop and forestry residues, household domestic waste, even cooking oil is produced. And British Airways have signed a contract with I think it's Philips, and they're going to be flying their aircraft on commercial flights. And I think BA are the first airline to use sustainable aviation fuel on a commercial scale. So that's one thing. But the problem with that is that the feedstock is going to be limited. There aren't enough McDonald's around the world to provide enough cooking oil. So you've got to figure out a way of producing. And the thing that's on the horizon is a thing called power to liquid. And basically what this is that if you think of fuel, basically it's a hydrocarbon. It's a compound of carbon and hydrogen, which you then mix with oxygen when you burn it, and obviously produce CO2 and water. Now, the proposal here is that if you can produce hydrogen by electrolysis from water using clean power, either wind, solar or nuclear, you can produce clean hydrogen, what's called green hydrogen. There are other ways of producing hydrogen, which is known as grey hydrogen, which is using coal-fired power stations to driving a coal-fired power station to drive electricity to the electrolysis. But what you need to do is green hydrogen, so you use renewable sources for your energy. And then if you can then take the CO2 out of the atmosphere, and there's about 0.04% of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If you can take it up by direct air capture, you can take that, you end up with CO2. You can convert that to carbon monoxide. And then there is a process called Fischer-Tropsch, which is a well-known process, which the Germans used during the Second World War to convert coal to aviation fuel, and the South Africans used it when there was an oil embargo to convert coal to oil. So Fischer-Tropsch is a well-known process, and using Fischer-Tropsch you can combine the carbon monoxide and the hydrogen and get your hydrocarbons. And if you think what the impact of that would be that the aircraft would be putting, would only be putting back into the atmosphere what had already been taken out. So there would be a net increase in carbon into the atmosphere. And think what that might do to the economy in this country. We didn't have to import.
Absolutely. Well, we're all understanding that now.
And I think that's where a lot of the effort has got to go. You've still got to do the improvements to the engine and the aircraft, but they won't hack it.
I think we're rounding to an end now. My usual question at this point is, and because you are dealing with so many students, you probably always have great advice. So I'm going to ask you anyway, what would you like to pass on to any budding young design engineers that want to follow in your footsteps?
I thought about this when we discussed this beforehand, and I'm always a bit wary about giving advice. But what I would say is that you should always try and be the best that you can in the job that you're doing. Always have a view on what you'd want to become. Never give up an opportunity to learn something, even if it seems to be a little bit of a diversion. I mean, when I went off and did development engineering, I learnt a lot from doing that. And I always say to students, do what's right, not what is easy. And I always refer to them, because a lot of the students will be going to engineering, some will go into design. And I refer them to Stanley Hooker's biography, Not Much of an Engineer. Stanley Hooker worked with Frank Whittle. And basically, he was a Cambridge mathematician who was recruited into Rolls, hence the title of his book, Not Much of an Engineer. And in his biography, I thought this was wonderful. I've just written this down so I can get it right. In his biography, I wrote, "The word engineer covers a variety of expertise and people of varying backgrounds, but in my experience, the creme de la creme of those are the designers. They are enthusiasts who seek after something more than wealth and power. They are indeed an elite body capable of defending their creation with lucid arguments. They have the most satisfying and rewarding job of all. They look at an engine and say, I created those parts, and they are exactly as I saw them in my mind, and they work."
Oh, that's terrific. And it really does represent, I think, our community at large.
I think it does.
Well, I think on that note, Jeff Kirk, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights. It's great. Thank you.
Very welcome, Mike.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, there are over 50 more featuring Royal designers from a wide range of disciplines, talking about their life and work. Just type RDI Insights-RSA into your browser and you'll find them.